This is a history project interview with Karen Kagan, and this is tape number one.
Okay. So, Dr. Kagan, I'm here to interview you about medicine and practicing in Worcester. But I don't really know what you do. I've heard it's internal medicine. Is that true?
Actually, not very much of that anymore.
No.
I've gone through a number of different iterations. My original internship was rotating, and I did a medical residency, mm-hmm. a cardiopulmonary fellowship for 3 years, after which I went into surgical critical care.
Where did you do all of these things?
I interned in Oklahoma City.
You did.
University of Oklahoma Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
See, it was a good way to see another part of the country and get paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did my residency and fellowship at Hartford Hospital in Hartford, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And through people I met there, I became acquainted with Dwight Harkin and went up to the Penn Brigham Hospital as associate director of their surgical critical care unit. And I was there for great years, I guess, and then went to St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester. I was there for 5.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I left full-time hospital medicine. I was doing emergency room in several hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And because my involvement at Farmville Hospital last summer that it was open, I met Dr. Oh dear. I started working at Southwood Community Hospital in the detox unit there with Dr. John Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed with NORCAP for 4 years.
And that's around here?
In Norfolk, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
When I was doing the moonlighting in hospital, the emergency rooms and so on, I also worked one summer down there.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Reed introduced me to Dr. Kelly, who was looking for a physician to staff the detox, which had just been moved out there after Norwood Hospital,
mm-hmm.
the old Pongo Hospital. And I've been in one way or another in that field ever since. I did one other stint in inpatient, working some in inpatient at Metro West Medical Center, Union Hospital, when Claire Selig opened the synthesis woman's addiction unit there, which was the first woman's unit in the state.
For detox?
Mm-hmm. Which is about all you have a chance to do anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very wonderful unit, very wonderful staff. And finally got to the point where I couldn't deal with being dictated how to practice medicine again. It was basically the same reason I left NORCAP, because third-party payers were literally dictating the practice of medicine.
Yeah,
get very sick patients in, and for the most part, they couldn't stay long enough to find their way out of a paper bag.
Mm-hmm.
So, in 87, I started working down in Franklin. We're now in Bellingham, outpatient counseling center. It's basically myself and my colleague, Kathy Seward.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where most all of my time goes now. However, I've also moonlighted at Westboro State Hospital since 1981, which has given me a very interesting juxtaposition of mental health and addictions.
Yeah. So all of the patients you work with now have addictive problems?
The majority of them do, but we have a general counseling practice, and there are some
that don't have any chemical dependency, other addictive disorders, or codependencies,
mm-hmm. but I think they're fairly few and far between.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well,
sort of big change from what you started out doing.
When I was in medical school, I was...
When was that?
I graduated in 1960 from New York University School of Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a psychiatrist who I think we all were quite impressed with, and I sort of toyed with the idea at that point.
You had?
But when I got into my, well, cardiopulmonary resuscitation was born the year I was doing my internship. And I can remember sitting around and people saying, oh, this is another fad that will never last.
CPR?
Yeah. Oh, it was still open chest resuscitation.
Really? Wow.
When I was a medical student, yes.
That's the first thing, CPR is the first thing we learn.
That's right. It's been incredible to see that in place and have lived through that. So I'm a gadgeteer at heart, and when I got into my residency, CPR obviously was new. With it came an explosion of apparatus, cardiac monitors, defibrillators, pacemakers, and so on. And I became very much involved with that, which is one of the things that brought me into the cardiopulmonary lab for my fellowship. And I was hooked by that time, so that the opportunity to go and work in the surgical ICUs at the Brigham was enough to have me off and gone.
Yeah. Using all of those gadgets. And are you from Worcester? Where did you grow up?
I was born in New York. Born in New York City, and I lived there till I was 9, and then we moved to Connecticut.
Okay. What part of Connecticut?
Wilton.
Where is that?
It's about an hour, 45 minutes north of New York. It's the southwestern corner.
And when was the first time you came to the fair?
That was 1967.
Yes.
When I started in the Brigham.
And were you living in near in the Boston area?
Or? We lived in Dedham.
Dedham.
And Westwood.
Okay.
Never in Boston proper.
Yeah. Not many.
I think I do.
And how long have you been in this company?
1987, sure.
Yeah.
No. Oh dear. 77 or 78, I think.
Okay. So, it sounds like CPR and a lot of the advances they were making sort of played a big role in what direction you went with medicine.
Played a tremendous role, because my original thinking when I went to medical school was I wanted to be a general practitioner. And not necessarily, completely rural-type areas. So we had a family friends with my parents. Wookie was a pediatrician and Jack was a surgeon. I lived in Oyster Bay. They really did a lot in the way of a lot of generalization in their practice, and their older daughter became a general practitioner and went up to Alaska, where she's still practicing.
Oh, wow.
And our family physician in Wilton, there was no physician in Wilton moved there in 45, except for somebody who was trying to go into retirement. When Dr. Maidman moved to town, he was, I think, a good deal of an influence on me, even to the point of, after trying to talk me out of going to medical school for several years, he loaned me his microscope for the duration.
And was he the doctor who was in
Wilton. In Wilton, mm-hmm. Yes, which...
The new doctor? You mean there's a new doctor?
He moved there, I guess, right after the...
No.
He must have gotten there about the same time we did.
Mm-hmm.
About 1945.
And he was your physician?
Yeah.
And, yeah.
He was in general practice.
Yeah. Yeah. Neat.
Yeah. Very special person.
Mm-hmm. And so all these people, what did you think about general practice?
I don't know really where that came from, or it may. I'd always wanted to be a doctor. Apparently, at one point, I considered something else because of the long school, and I fireman or something
yeah.
like that. That was when I was five or so. But basically, I stayed with the concept of medicine,
mm-hmm.
and there wasn't that much in the way of specialization back then.
Mm-hmm.
My father had severe congenital cardiac disease, and there were cardiologists, but there really wasn't very much you could do about it.
Yeah.
He died about a year after White Hart did the first. Closed my book, Mishra, and never was a candidate for any kind of surgery or anything.
Mm-hmm. So your exposure
was
cardiology?
Really more general kind of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And stayed that way. I managed to severely limit my exposure to hospitals. I had my tonsils out when I was 18 months old.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the next time I was in the hospital, it was with pneumonia when I was a third-year student, so.
Third-year student, that's great.
So I really didn't have any concept of anything but kind of
still
the general
learning.
Practice of medicine.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking when I got into medical school and started learning about microbiology and so on, it seemed like all frontiers had been crossed.
Really?
How wrong I was.
I just assume things are going to change every day, forever.
Right. They are, sure. We're a little wiser now.
Yeah.
But then you're always expected to hang out my shingles in the corner. And shorts are good by all the things going on. The rapid burgeoning of intensive care. When I started at Hartford Hospital, there was no intensive care of any sort.
Mm-hmm.
Neurosurgery put in the first year, but there was a very active neurosurgical department there. And then surgical unit was the next. Eventually, medicine got a cardiac intensive care unit.
Mm-hmm.
Just a total evolution from what hospitals were like there, which was basically bedside nursing of a classical form, into more and more as it's going on now.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in the surgical unit, we got some monitoring equipment, and there were plug-in units for whether you were going to do EKG and pressure monitoring, and EKG monitoring on two patients or whatnot. God forbid the nurses have anything to do with that.
Yeah.
And,
too high tech.
Much too high tech. So I sputtered a bit, but finally one day came when I couldn't get out of the cath lab to come up and do something right away. And the nurse said, well, I've watched you do it. Don't you think I could do it? And I said, absolutely. But, you know, it's incredible that when we had people on EKG monitoring,
mm-hmm.
the nurses could take the leads off. They couldn't put them back on again. I had some run-ins with the nursing director on that score.
You mean questioning you why they couldn't put them on? Or?
No. My saying, you know, you know, the marks are there. It doesn't matter that precisely, you know. Oh, no. It was also a time when nurses couldn't change IV bottles, other such charming things.
They seem to be doing a lot as of the summer in pediatric surgery. The nurses seem to do a lot.
That was really a decade of change. Things came very rapidly. Because with the explosion of techniques of EKG monitoring and everything else that went with it, there is more and more of a need for the staff who are on site to be able to do the things mm-hmm. they needed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, physicians were needed, but you can't really make a go of CPR and intensive monitoring and management unless the people who are on site are doing it. That did take a while in some places. A friend of mine was visiting an ICU somewhere.
What time?
Was when I was at Brigham. That was probably around 70-71. Mm-hmm. We were working with Hewlett Packard on some very early cardiac monitoring equipment at that point. And then went somewhere, well-known place,
mm-hmm.
and he was standing with the nurse at the bedside, and looking at the monitor, and he asked something about the pattern on the screen or something, and she said, "Oh, I'll ask the technician," which is literally what she did. In a back room, all of the signals were remoted. And there was a technician watching them.
Mm-hmm.
And the nurses at the bedside really weren't having anything to do with this.
No to do there. Yeah.
Well, it just was felt to be too high-tech or whatnot. And that never has been my kind of a feeling. And I'm fairly good at teaching. So that, we had some problems at Brigham, I mean, at Hartford, as far as what the nurses could and couldn't do,
mm-hmm.
When I got to the Brigham, there weren't constraints of that sort. There was unknowledgeability. And so that was a lot of fun working to really put the nurses in charge of what they were doing
mm-hmm.
and to use the equipment to serve them and the patients, not to be slaves to the equipment.
Right.
It's
if you're going to have nurses there, they might as well doing as much as they can.
Well, it doesn't make sense to take the information that you get with EKG monitor and pressure monitoring and so on and put a third party in between
mm-hmm.
the nurse who's at the bedside should be able to simply use all of this. And it was, mm-hmm. I found it very interesting as the surgical unit got going to see how the nurses weren't even aware of how aware they were of going what was going on. Even in central monitoring and whatnot, it wasn't a terribly large room.
Mm-hmm.
But many times a monitor would do something odd and staff who weren't the least bit aware that they had been listening to anything, heads would turn.
Realize
what was going on.
Yeah.
Just, they were so familiar with the stuff, and since they were doing the monitoring, they were involved with the patients, they just used all the data just as they would have used a patient calling to them.
Mm-hmm.
It was great to see that. Girl.
And you said nurses weren't divided into drugs?
No IV drugs at Hartford Hospital. I don't think they could do any IV at all.
Oh, is that right? So then doctors needed to come in, bag ran out, they'd have to put another bag?
That's right. And one of the things that happened before I left Well, that's Bellevue. I think it's dark.
That should be fine.
Okay. when I... Shortly after, I guess, I got to... Harvard Hospital. There started being available plastic stopcocks and so on for IVs. And that managed to get snuck in. As a matter of fact, I usually had a couple on my purse and I knew where to get them in the OR.
Oh, yeah.
And I was called the stopcock lady. At Coles. You know, but I would, I got to the point where I could figure out how to hook up IVs by stopcock, and at least some places could get the nurses to turn them. And then when I was working with a patient with a disseminated fungal disorder and the amphotericin had to be turned off, ran it. Had to run in over a certain time, and there weren't piggybacks and so on that much available. But I learned if I put a certain amount of heparin in it, when the line, when it ran out, the line would stay patent for a period of time. And so that gave me the, you know, didn't have me totally tied to the IV. There were lots of things like that that we had to do in order to really get the, patient's best interest taken care of.
I've heard them mention heparin before, but I didn't realize exactly why.
Well, that's, it's used in heparin locks now, where there is either a small catheter or a needle in the vein and a connector on it which dead ends, and either an IV can be plugged into it and run, or when the IV's finished or the medication or whatnot, then the line is flushed with a small amount of the heparin-containing solution and will stay patent for a significant period of time.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the same idea, only I was doing it by putting heparin in the bag, which was also helpful to reduce inflammation in the vein due to the amphotericin solution. You've probably never ever seen a bottle of blood. They were our nemesis for a while.
Yeah.
Because with a bottle of blood, you have to, I'm sure they don't exist anymore, put a needle in one port, which was a glass tube that went up so that air could come in so the blood would come out. But you had to do it just right. We had one classmate who was lousy at IVs, and we sort of tried to protect his patients. And remember once changing an IV a couple of times before we figured out that the blood wasn't bottle wasn't vented or something like that. The bags are infinitely safer and better.
Yeah. How often do people drop bottles or...
That happened on occasion.
It's scarier nowadays.
Yes, there was no concern back then about AIDS, obviously, and hepatitis really hadn't reared its head. There was hepatitis. Back in those days, it was felt that hepatitis A was strictly fomite disseminated, and hepatitis B strictly transmitted by blood or body fluid contact. It was some work that was done at a very, very large school for the retarded on Long Island, I believe, that proved that both types of hepatitis could be transmitted both ways. We really weren't that concerned back then about the dangers that came somewhat later.
When was the switch made from bottles to bags? I was assumed everything came back.
No,
your time.
There was a lot of discussion. See, I think I must have been at, I was at Brigham, because I remember Carl Walter talking about plasticizers and so on. You know, at Hartford, there were bags at Hartford that I know. Probably, imagine in the early 60s, there's a gradual conversion. I think some of the blood products came in bags a lot earlier. And gradually, the bags came. They were a lot safer for a lot of reasons, one of which was to pump blood in. You had to hook up a blood pressure, you know, rubber tube of a blood pressure that goes into a blood pressure cuff. You put that into the air vent of the bottle and pump. But of course, you had to stay glued to the bottle because if the blood ran out, then the air would run out. So.
Watch that closely.
Very closely. So that was scary. Whereas with a bag, you can, whatever you're using to pump it in with, you can pump that up full and forget about it because it'll just collapse down to nothing when it empties out.
Did they always have drips on them for fresh freezing bags? I don't know how else you could do it, but.
The set that plugged into the bag had a drip chain.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And, and the blood ones had filters on them to keep the particulate matter out of the individual. Red cell ghosts and so on. I really hadn't thought about bottles for a long time.
There are a lot of things like that that changed over the years. And just when they were changing were a big deal of it then.
And of course, all IV solutions were in bottles too. Saline and everything else. Made for real good, quick underwater seal for a chest tube. Why? Grab one of those, turn it, you know, a bottle of saline or something. Could work as that. Back in those days, disposables were very, very limited. I remember one summer, the unit I was on was in the hospital as a student. We died and gone to heaven because one of the student nurses got so mad about dull needles that she learned how to sharpen needles.
Oh, really?
And every unit had its stock of needles, and every afternoon, you know, they were whatever, somebody on the floor would clean them and set them up on a tray, wrap them, and they'd go and be autoclaved and come back. At the same unit, so we had sharp needles without burrs for some while. And gradually the disposables became more and more and more into it. When I was at the Brigham, most of what we used for setting up for the pressure monitoring on the open hearts and so on were steel. Stainless steel valve systems, stopcock systems, which had to be taken apart and cleaned and put back together and put up and autoclaved. And
like different, it feels like everything's thrown out.
Right.
At the end of the operation. That's what I've been watching this summer.
There's a tremendous amount. I don't know whether it's all good that it's disposable. Yeah.
It seems very wasteful, but then again, safer. Things that need to be sterile or some things you can't be sterilized, some things you can.
Yeah. Other things when I was in my internship and residency, most patients had a physician, an internist, or general practitioner, or a great many people did. So nice if you were in the emergency room and Mrs. Jones came in with some chest pain, you'd do the basics. And then you'd call whoever the doctor was, describe the situation, told, well, she does this all the time, blah, 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 or she never complains, admit her.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we also didn't have to fight with third-party peers and so on to admit people. I wonder what would have ever happened to one elderly man who were two practitioners, general practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
One of the suburbs of Hartford. Kearney, and I forgot the name of the other man. And they were both very, very busy people. Did very little in the way of hospital work, usually admitted mm-hmm. patients to somebody else, but their clinical acumen was legendary. So one evening, this patient was sent an older man. He sent him in. It was basically kind of a failure to thrive. And I saw him in the emergency room. And there really didn't seem to be very much wrong with him. Oh, he hadn't been eating and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, did the preliminaries, put him in bed, fed him, ran a bunch of tests the next morning. Things were coming back pretty normal. Through the day, nurse went in to send him up for dinner, and he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing really dramatic or impressive, but Carney had seen something.
Huh.
It was really quite amazing.
Yeah, and he just knew his patient well enough to know that there was nothing obviously wrong.
Well, there were some situations where our hands were tied. Back in those days, as a resident fellow, there was, well, first there was external cardiac pacemakers. And very slowly, there evolved the internal ones, which required a thoracotomy. And some people were not well enough with advanced cardiac disease for a thoracotomy. And there was a very limited amount you could do. You could hook them up to an external pacemaker, put an extension cord on them, but it really tethered people. In the cath lab, the transvenous pacemaker started to come into play. And Dr. McLean insisted the first six or so be done in the cath lab, not by radiologists or anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
With Tom Donovan, the cardiac surgeon, scrubbed and standing behind us in case anything happened.
Mm-hmm.
But after the first six or eight, gradually, it became a radiologist's domain.
Mm-hmm.
Started so much of the invasive work that radiologists do now. I was the one for a long time that went up and monitored for them, because that was not something there was that much familiarity with. So that was quite interesting. And gradually, I remember one man who came in, he had a huge inguinal hernia.
Mm-hmm.
And it gotten to the point where it had to be operated on, and he had complete heart block at a very slow rate. So arrangements were made for him to come in, have a temporary pacemaker put in,
mm-hmm.
have surgery, and then it would be taken out, temporary transvenous. And when I first saw him the night before, he would talk along, and then he'd stop talking, and then he'd talk, and he'd stop talking. And I usually, when I went in to interview a patient, I would, especially a cardiac patient, I would take the pulse. It's a contact, a bond, and whatnot.
Yeah.
And when his heart would be along for a while, and it'd stop beating, and then he'd stop talking, and
yeah.
then he'd start beating again, and then he'd start
wow.
talking. So, got the temporary pacemaker in, and after surgery, we were talking. And the most impressive thing to him was that he wasn't having all the problems with gas that he'd been having.
Oh, yes.
Which was obviously part of, you know, better cardiac output.
Mm.
And he's saying, you know, isn't there some way I could keep one of these? I'm sitting there, and I'm not supposed to, you know. He said, well, why don't you talk to Dr. Twaddle about it? Maybe he can do something,
mm-hmm.
because the permanent transvenous were still quite new.
Yeah.
So the guy talked Dr. Twaddle into it and went out a very happy man.
Good.
But it took a lot to get people for things like that. Pacemakers got better and better. More people could use them.
Mm-hmm.
We went from AC defibrillators, which you only use to defibrillate somebody. It was like hooking them up to the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And then the DC machines came in and untapped a tremendous amount of capability. We ended up with more equipment than we expected to at Hartford because somebody goofed on ordering. And all of a sudden the OR acquired one DC defibrillator cardioverter monitor and the other one. There were two units that were far more than anybody had expected
yeah.
to get. But they didn't get turned. Taken away. One of them was in use within the first week, so that added to the equipment that we had.
Mm-hmm.
EKG machines, they were all single channel. You know, there was no such thing as three-channel EKG machines
mm-hmm.
or automatic doing. I got real good at running one. Still got one upstairs. It was Dwight Harkin's office machine.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he gave it to me.
Oh.
And a couple of other old units. A couple of explosion-proof OR monitors that I acquired when the cellar at the Griffith was being cleaned out.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Some retro
old stuff. Yeah. One of them, I think, may be one of the first 25 electronics from medicine made because it doesn't have a serial number. I was told that by somebody, but I don't know that for sure. Not there. Tucked away in the attic.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, just so much that came along that added a great deal of quality of life. When closed chest resuscitation first became fairly widely used, there was a lot of very serious concern that it would create a great many brain dead people who were being kept alive.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't materialize quite as much as people were worried about. Of course, a lot of people died of whatever it was that caused the cardiac arrest.
Would you consider it a good advance?
Tremendous advance. Saw a lot of people who had a new chance in life. One was a man who had recurrent ventricular fibrillation.
Mm-hmm.
And He had, was well known to his cardiologist. His cardiologist was going out to do a home visit, was delayed, which was just as well.
This is tape number two of Dr. Karen Kagey.
Well, this chap went into fibrillation when the cardiologist got out there and ambulance was called. There was no such thing as portable defibrillators and whatnot at that point. So he was kept alive with CPR for about 45 minutes on the way in. He reverted to a sinus rhythm as they rolled up to the hospital. But he certainly wouldn't have gone anywhere but to a funeral parlor if it hadn't been for that. And then with all of this, he was put in a private room with private duty nurses, and I was up on the floor for something else one evening, well, that evening or the next evening, and the nurse came down the hall, and she said, and we knew the nurses didn't know anything about EKGs, you know, or anything. She came down and she said, something's different.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, fine. Down to the room, and he was back in VTAC.
Oh.
And so we were able to deal with that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was this nurse who just, she didn't know what, she says, I don't know what it is, but it's different. So I want to let you know.
Right. Yeah.
So, lots of things happen. Dialysis was another thing that was very early. There, acute dialysis had been going on for a number of years at Hartford, and I was involved with that for 2 or 3 years. Was fine for overdoses, fine for acute renal failure. But we had one person, I don't remember too much about it, but had developed, chronic renal failure after probably septic shock and light.
Mm-hmm.
And just was showing no signs after several weeks of developing any kind of renal output at all. We called and called and tried to get the patient up to the Brigham, because they were starting to do chronic dialysis and all. And there was a long waiting list, and the patient died before anything could be done. Now, and chronic dialysis is nothing to particularly, you know, get worried about. If somebody needs it,
right,
they get it.
That's a thing that you do. So now you're doing more counseling?
Counseling. I work with a lot of people who have addictive disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Very few with whom that's a single diagnosis. People who are single diagnosis basically can walk into the halls of AA and get into recovery, get their lives together. But there are a tremendous number of people who have other illnesses which stand in the way of their getting into any kind of recovery. And recovery is healing from the neuroadaptive disorders, not just putting down the drink and the drug. That's another arena where I've seen a lot of change. When I first started at NORCAP in the beginning of 82, the detox was an 8-day detox, and people who came over to the lodge for rehab came to a 28-day program. So the first year or so I was there, I was continuing basically a 36-day length of stay for anybody who backed back the two programs. I think even before Blue Cross started,
putting the pressure on. We were shaving days off the detox if a person was definitely going over mm-hmm. to watch, and that was perfectly appropriate. But I'd been there about a year and a half when suddenly it looked like the whole thing might come to a grinding stop, because suddenly Blue Cross had decreed that they were not going to do any more advance payments, but it was all going to be after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they clearly, they'd hit Massachusetts, they'd hit California and Illinois before. Terry Gorski, who's a real leader in the field, did a lot of work with us on improving our program and so on at that point. But because of John Kelly's contacts with people who's backed off and said, well, it'd be a 3-month educational period, whatever, which was interesting in some ways. They had two women nurses come and spend, I think it was 3 months at the lodge. One of them had to back out very early because of acute family illness. The other one was a fairly young woman with no background in the addictions, but a good person, and I started understanding some of what they were talking about. And but it was a time of a lot of stress. Also, they had done a retrospective review of 20 charts. It was 20 and come up with like 300 days of disagreement. They said they shouldn't have been paid for. And these same charts were sent to 3 or 4 national authorities around the country and came back with something like 5 days of disagreement.
Uh-huh.
During this period of time, got some real insight into how they played the game. We had a man in his 50s with cirrhosis. This was his 3rd or 4th time at the lodge, which was unheard of, but everybody was really pulling for this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he, at this point, really, you know, stressing, you gotta document every day why somebody needs to be in treatment and so on. But the second week he was there, team decided maybe he was depressed. A real good psychiatrist consulting, and he agreed, so man was put on antidepressants and started to show some response. And it put everything in a real bind, because the team had felt up to them that his only chance was going to a halfway house.
Mm-hmm.
There was no way he could go to a halfway house on antidepressants. So we really felt that he needed to be in until the antidepressants took hold. And I was documenting that chart of the yin yang.
Yeah.
You know, talking about his, you know, quoting him as far as suicidal ideation.
Right. Whatnot. Just make sure it's all very clear.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. let's say that started on the 21st of some month.
Mm-hmm.
They cut him off on the 22nd.
Really?
It was all this documentation in the chart, and not a word or anything. It really is very, very scary, the power that the insurance companies have. And this is the particular area where I see it the most, because the managed care hadn't hit the more general hospital population when I was involved with that. I saw the length of stay at the lodge go from 28 days down to 18 or so when I got out. Mentality. At chart rounds one morning, the nursing director said that reviewing the charts, it seemed like most of the Bay State patients were staying 28 days, which was what they were allowed. And so I had to listen to this drill for a few minutes and then said, well, most of these patients need 30, but 28's all they get. And the response was, well, you know, discharge them at 26 or 27 days, it'll look better. Those are lives.
Yeah.
That are being
people or organizations have never even met the patient.
That's right. And
dictating.
It was interesting to me because a long time ago, and I don't know where I heard this or read it, Kaiser Permanente, which was the first HMO, started out in California, had apparently, you know, looked at this whole question, and because they treated everybody in the family, so if there was an identified alcoholic or addict, they could identify all of the money that they were paying out, family and all, and decided that to stop doing the monitoring because it was money well spent. But apparently they never brought the data to really publishable kinds of control because, you know, that wasn't what they were interested in and they were satisfied for themselves. I heard another fascinating speaker at NECAD a number of years ago. It was the last speaker of a 3-day program. It was like noon, almost noon on a Saturday. Didn't sound all that thrilling a topic. Came down the aisle looking like a, you know, a retired military person. Sure, I figured I was going to have a good snooze. He was riveting. He was working with Siva Corning, owns Corning in their aircraft division. He had been brought on board about 2 years earlier to oversee their addictions work, EAP. They had a lot of pilots, losing a pilot, or buying a pilot out of commission for a long, long time. It's very, very expensive. Pilots are expensive. So the powers that be decided to have somebody come in and see if he could shake things up. He was given total carte blanche. They pulled out of all the addictions work out of insurance and just underwrote it. He picked about 20 facilities around the country because they're a national organization to send people to, send patients to. So it's not that there aren't other good places, but I wanted to have a select number of places where I really knew the staff, knew exactly what was going on. He was given the go-ahead to identify people early on. Gradually developed quite a network. When somebody was identified as having a problem, he could put some real elbow on them, you know, jobs at stake. As soon as somebody was ready, he'd get them back at work, not in a, you know, make-work job, but in, you know, something where they, you know, were using their head. And after a short time, he had pilots back on the flight line within 6 months and staying there. At the time that he gave this talk, he'd been told about a month earlier that they were pulling all the rest of the EAP out of insurance and putting it under him because he was spending a good deal of money in a way that gave him returns all over. So, you know, there is information that the treatment does work. Some of the data that suggests treatment doesn't work was done with populations with a very low potential of recovery. So if you take a, you know, group of people that has a lot of strikes against them, it's going to be hard to see much of a difference with different kinds of treatment. Edge Hill was starting to look at that a year or so before they closed. I never did see the final article. Tracking a cohort of people going through that were either employed men, stably employed men, stably employed women, unemployed wives who didn't have to work. Everybody coming through for a period of time who met their criteria, who was willing to have follow-up, who was willing to have a significant other included in the follow-up. And they were starting to get some good data, and they were looking at aftercare and so on, how different people did with different things. I don't know exactly how that came out. But I do know, from what I've seen in treatment, from what I've seen in my own practice, the majority of people who can't seem to get clean and sober have other issues. Got one patient who I've been seeing for about 3 years. He's run a hell in a handbasket in the last 9 months. I'm certain that what it is he's starting to have awarenesses of abuse. I can't talk to him about anything for more than 3 or 4 minutes that puts any kind of pressure before he shuts off and says he can't deal with it. But he did tell me about a couple of nightmares he had, which fit in with a lot of things I've suspected, just from a lot of other stuff that was going on. He's been in and out of very short-term detoxes, which is probably going to have died. Got another woman who is almost 40. She's never been able to deal with giving up a child. 22 years ago, she's an incest survivor. She's been in a long-term, very volatile relationship. She's got a 6-year-old son. She just has been going around and around. Detoxes. She did 2 years ago. She was Section 35, which she really wanted. Went through about 3 weeks of a rehab and then went into a halfway house for some months. She got out early because there were things at home that needed doing and whatnot. She was hooked up with an educational program, a college program. I was absolutely appalled when I heard it. Now, this is a woman who isn't even finished drying out yet, really. She really did very well, with very well in school for about a year. Took a horrendous toll on her. She got lots of praise for getting A's and so on, but she wasn't doing anything like recovery. She relapsed. Been back and forth. I'd see her for a few times. She called me last Sunday. Desperate to get dried out. Her significant other had walked out on her a couple weeks before. Saw her Sunday night, got it started on liver and cholesterol. I didn't think it was going to work, but, you know. Monday night, she drank again, surprise, surprise. Let's see what she did what. She got PC. She ended up being evaluated by the crisis team as possible suicidality. Got hospitalized. They let her out on Thursday for court, which was a hearing on the 209A that her significant other had taken out 2 weeks earlier. No, it didn't help. One day. And one day she took off. She got loaded. She night. Oh, she violated 209A. I don't know where she is now. The psychiatrist at the hospital she was at was going to go for Section 35, which is commitment for up to 30 days for treatment of addictions. The only trouble is that there's essentially no place you can 35 somebody to that's locked that will get the intensive kind of treatment that is needed. There are two women's Section 35 units, both open, women's health in Boston and Fall River Star Program. And they're both geared for women who are well enough to want to get well. To have the skills to do something with it. They're both termed dual diagnosis in the sense that they will, with some screening, take people who are on antidepressants or may carry a diagnosis of bipolar disorder or something like that. But there is an incredible philosophical dichotomy between addictions programs and psych programs. In psych programs, the patient is deemed sick. The patient doesn't want treatment as a threat to themselves or others. Psychiatric institutions have a concept that they're supposed to do something with this person and get them well enough to understand that they should want to get better and be able to take off and go on their own. In addiction facilities, the construct is that we've got something to offer, and if you want it, fine. If you don't, fine.
That's very different.
It's totally different. An analogy I use that most people react to is, let's say your best friend has gotten into a pretty deep depression, and she has been talking about wanting to get out of this veil of tears. She makes a significant suicide attempt. She gets sent into a hospital. She doesn't want to be there. Section 12 is done, commitment for up to 10 days of treatment. And if at the end of 10 days she says she doesn't want to be there, and the staff feel that it, you know, is totally unsafe for her to be out, and they'll go for a court commitment. That's, you know, a psych hospital feels that's what it's supposed to do. If on the fifth day, nurse walks in and finds her with the sheet tied tightly around her neck, can you conceptualize somebody going and saying, let me untie it. We can't have this. You know, there's sick people on the unit. We can't have you trying to suicide on the unit. You know, you're going to have a administrative discharge, and when you decide you want to do something about your suicidality, come on back and we'll... You know, that would be a lawsuit so fast.
Yeah.
This is done day in and day out in addictions facilities.
Yeah.
Somebody comes in, they get mouthy, or maybe they're found with something on them. There's the door.
So it only works with the
people who are well enough, who are well enough. Now, that doesn't mean to say that a lot of people who can't make it don't want it, but they aren't well enough to. The basic things that are needed for getting well, trust. There are an awful lot of addicts out there who have very good reasons not trusting. PTSD can do a tremendous amount to create habit. A person who drinks does so to a problem does so because it's very real, very, very real game. It normalizes brain function for a bit. It deadens the pain in a way that it doesn't do for somebody who's not an alcoholic. And when pain gets too bad, people drink. This woman, this man, both do the same thing. Pain just gets so bad that they can't deal with it. When you can take somebody like that, lock them up, keep them safe,
mm-hmm.
and work as much as possible on treatment issues, if you hang in there for a while, your potential of getting past that is somewhat to fairly good.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that I see happen at Westboro periodically. A certain number of the patients who are there are alcoholic or addicts, in addition to having to have some real psychiatric diagnosis to get in there. But I've seen people who contained long enough, able to sputter, fume, fury, cry, and whatnot, get it out of their system, to have some consistency for a period of time,
mm-hmm.
to get their depression treated if that's what they've got, their ADD, what have you, get their PTSD validated, then there's potential of getting better. There was almost some recognition of this 10 years ago in the field when people could get into treatment fairly readily, stay in treatment, when you knew how long you were going to stay in treatment. There were certainly some people who didn't need 28 days at the lodge, and sometimes we found ourselves kind of in a dilemma of, really, there's no reason why he can't go home Saturday when his wife comes up and he's supposed
mm-hmm.
to leave Monday. But at least people could come in and know they'd be there for 4 weeks. It would often take about a week for the walls to come down, for them to start figuring out what was going on, start to set up some tentative contact
mm-hmm.
connections with staff and with peers. And a week is not too long to get into closure.
Mm-hmm.
and to start sealing over and figuring out what you're going to do. If you have 4 weeks, that leaves you 2 weeks in between.
Yeah.
To have some vulnerability, to figure out what's going on and so on, to go through a consistent type of a pattern. I saw a lot of people start to realize for the first time that they'd come from dysfunctional families, that they didn't have recovery skills. Things that they were adamant about when they came in as far as family history started to change. Not because they were lying when they came in, because they just plain didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
We had two or three people whose big stumbling block at first was if they accepted that they had an illness that they didn't cause, that they weren't responsible for. And by learning how to deal with that illness, they could get well. That meant they had to backtrack and recognize that dear old dad who beat the hell out of them also had a disease.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something that a person comes to an insight about the second day of treatment and says, oh, I need to deal with this. It's something that evolves. It's something that a therapist, a counselor, who's gotten to know them,
mm-hmm.
you know, can bring out. We had one patient who came in to get off Valium. He'd been on Valium for about 12 years through the VA, and he'd been hearing that it was not a nice thing. So he wanted to come in. His psychiatrist wasn't at all thrilled about the idea. He was somebody with Vietnam vet with fairly severe PTSD. We'd done some work on it. On admission, he insisted that he wasn't an alcoholic. He just wanted to get off this Valium. Stuck to his guns, and about 2.5 weeks into it, we were chatting in my office one day. He said, did you ever do anything odd or embarrassing when you were drinking? Dance with a lampshade on your head or anything like that?
all of a sudden it came spilling out that when he got home from NOM, he was being PC'd almost every weekend. He'd work all week. Saturday night he'd be out drinking. That came to a halt when his wife threatened to leave him. And basically he got transferred from alcohol to Valium through the VA, which eliminated all the drinking type of stuff. And kind of put a lid on that. But as we talked, he started looking back and started putting some pieces together, two and two together. He ended up splitting just before he came off the Valium, but I heard later on that he'd gone to Edgehill a couple of days later, and somebody had seen him in an NA meeting 9 or 10 months later, and he was doing well. But so often, people have some or another kind of stereotype of alcoholic. They don't fit their stereotype.
Yeah.
They just don't recognize, you know, what's going on. It takes time. People who are able to stay dry or stay dry enough to think and are able to connect with the program can do this. Those that have panic disorder can't sit in a meeting. Those who don't trust, those who haven't learned how to identify and they can only compare, they don't get much of anything out of program. Those who are depressed may not be able to have to get up and go to meetings. Those who go to meetings and do all of that but have such horror in their lives because of PTSD or the like, a panic disorder, may not be able to put down the bottle. I've been working with a couple for over a year now, home visit. He was just sort of there. As a student. And it was a long, long time before I found out she'd been nipping. They were scared stiff that if DSS found out, the children would be taken again. Which wouldn't have been true because the children weren't at risk at this point in time. Then, a little while after that secret came out and got kind of put in its place, came out that there was some significant battering going on. Not all the time. Kids were never involved. But it took about 8 or 10 months before that fact could kind of crawl out.
Yeah.
Once it did, we started dealing with it.
Yeah.
And a lot of things have changed. He never wanted to do it. And it was always when they were both drinking. He had reservations about his drinking, I'm pretty sure, when I started seeing him. Gradually, they disappeared, and now he doesn't have any question about his ability to drink and save time. In that particular case, things have moved relatively well without inpatient treatment. Got her through one kind of nasty alcohol detox. She's on the tail end of a benzo detox. She ended up getting one from her primary and from a psychiatrist in her town who was quite free with prescription pad. Again, it was something that was a secret for about 6 months. Her husband really didn't know about it until towards the end. One day and wanted to know if I could come over, which I couldn't. And she just blurted it out. She said, I gotta tell you. Okay. So, embarked on a rather slow detox. You need to be flexible. I know a lot of people who are cut loose by their treaters if they pick up. That has never made an awful lot of sense to me. If somebody needs help when they're not drinking, why is it that they don't need help when they pick up? This is real insanity out there. That just unreal. So that's kind of become a central pivot of my professional life.
That's it.
Yeah, my tend to get into some other things. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is kind of a spinoff. I've now got probably 15 people from 4 to 66, maybe more.
That's sort of along from the same lines as a lot of the other things.
In many ways it is.
And for me,
there are times when I miss the ICU and so on. But with what I'm doing right now, it's really a fascinating ability to pull on things that I've done for years in different iterations.
Not so formally either.
Just pulling from where I need them. One situation, I have a patient who's has an eating disorder. He was bulimic for about 15 years, in his early 30s. Has stopped gambling. He's an ACOA. It wasn't 100% clear why he came to us. He bounced from another agency. He saw my colleague a couple of times. Was definitely med-seeking to some degree. He wanted Valium. He insisted that he couldn't eat. The stuff just stayed in his stomach. He wasn't trying to vomit a lot of the time, but it would just come up. He also had been through some GI studies, which showed extremely slow motility.
Is that right?
So it kind of went along with this. He got drunk. He made a suicide gesture. He ended up in a couple of hospitals. I figured I'd never see him again. He ended up at Leonard Morse at the eating program and lasted there about 3 days. And was discharged or left because he insisted he couldn't eat the meals. It was a structured eating type of thing. So he came back and he brought all his stuff with him. You know, his records, workups he had. So I thought, well, I'll try and ensure liquid diet. And that didn't do very much better than a solid diet. So I go plucking out of 15-odd years ago and said, well, why don't we try you on a total enteric diet? Vitamix is a water aqueous solution of amino acids, carbohydrate, vitamins, minerals. It is something that was developed to totally take the place of oral intake. People with short bowel syndrome and so on. I had worked with it early on when I was at the Griffin. Hadn't heard of it for a long time. It took me a while to
think of it.
Finally find out where it could be gotten and so
right.
on. And then we had to go through a PA prior approval form. And I'm thinking, this is probably going to be white foot.
Yeah.
See. He can handle it.
Is that right?
He's adequately nourished. He's gained a little weight, which doesn't thrill him. He's been able to hang in with that. He's gotten very involved with OA. And he's making some very substantial progress in all ways. Obviously, none of his other treaters had thought in terms of, well, maybe this guy truly can't eat regular food.
Yeah.
And maybe if he has something that will stay down, that will nourish him, will handle whatever kinds of mild nutritional deficits he has, will allow him to feel back in control of being able to ingest what he needs. Well, maybe we can do something. He's been on it for about 5 months.
This is Dr. Karen Kagey, tape number 3.
But that's an example of how I was able to pull from critical care work, which
theoretically wouldn't have any overlap at all
mm-hmm.
with addictions counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Some patients have Medicaid or other insurances. I had a number of people with no insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go to doctors very much because of the price. There's some, I'm not going to do any major medicine, but, if somebody with recurrent bronchitis develops an acute bout, be able to prescribe an antibiotic.
Mm-hmm.
And say, this is it, this works, or, you got to take yourself somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Things as simple as facial acne, which often responds very well to something like a topical clindamycin.
Mm-hmm.
You might be able to do that.
So you still do work with type of thing when appropriate.
That's right.
Yeah.
Some patients have other medical illnesses, and to be able to address that in some way
mm-hmm.
can be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
One or two kind of over-anxious people who I can put symptoms into perspective.
Mm-hmm.
There is also something about being a physician that sometimes gives my words more weight than they might have from somebody else. That still is very, very true in all aspects of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly can be abused, but it can also be a very significant part of working with a patient.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the art of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who just hear better because I'm a physician, believe a little better because I'm a physician. Sometimes if I'm seeing somebody for meds, being able to reinforce what they've been told by my colleague or whoever they're seeing,
mm-hmm.
or just kind of doing a little, side approach can reinforce in a very special way a message that they've already gotten, but they're a little leery of.
Yes.
And that's real nice to be able to do that.
Yeah.
I'm also doing a lot of, probably a quarter of my practice is home visits. Which, of course, is something I originally had presumed I'd be doing
mm-hmm.
35 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing people in their own surroundings, seeing some things that are real eye-openers.
Yeah.
Sometimes being able to press somebody into getting medical attention
mm-hmm.
because I see something that worries me
mm-hmm.
and ask the right questions and then kind of make the right noises and somebody, may go see a doctor when they
mm-hmm.
wouldn't have otherwise or with just the family members. Physician can do a lot of things with people, and it's really fun.
Yeah. Sounds like you've done a lot of different things with people over your career. Done a lot of
different things, and yet there's a lot of overlap.
Yeah. It's really nice to hear you talk about the different things you've done now, and to realize there are overlaps, but also that it is flexible too. That if I choose one area of medicine, not concrete set in that area.
Definitely not. Certainly, making a living in medicine has undergone a lot of change. There are a lot of advantages to, you know, just joining a group and being on salary and doing what you're supposed to be there. It'd be nice not to worry about keeping a roof over my head. But I also know that I'm just not willing to go back to having somebody telling me to practice medicine. I'm getting better at filling my one billing in December.
Yeah.
We had somebody doing part-time billing, but Kathy and I are lousy at getting our data in on time, so I took it over. I've gotten better. I also had, it was a real educational thing. We got turned down, put on hold for about $2,000 worth of billing. It was back 94, billing that Kathy had finally given me 95. And kept getting kind of different stories. And finally, one day, it was in April or May, I was down in somewhere on the coast at court with a patient. And I got paged. I was out on the front steps in the sun. And so it was the insurance company, and it was still on hold. For some reason, I just called. So I talked to a different woman. Well, now she tells me that the problem is that they need... No, I know. They've been saying they needed data on the children's natural father and the mother. And that's what it kicked out, because the kid's name is different from the mother's name. She's remarried, her husband has insurance. So, I said, well, yeah, she said, and the woman was looking around on her computer and all, and, you know, we have, you know, the data for 1993 and 1994. We don't have it for 1995, so it has to be updated every year. But that's the first time, you know, that made sense to me.
Okay.
Said, you have it for 1994. She said, yes. Then, is there any reason you can't release the 1994? There was dead silence at the other end of the phone. And, you know, about a week later, we got a check for that part. It's incredible how much you can miss by doing this. I picked up some other things, because I had this my stuff in the computer, and I was getting at least the dates of the other people's clients in the computer. One HMO, not their right payer. I had checked, and they paid, you know, up to $500, so we got $375, and then we're getting, you know, out of benefits. So, okay, that was 80% of $500, $350, so I'm thinking to myself, well, does this make sense? Is it $500, since it's an 80%? So I called, well, no, it's $500. I said, well, why are we getting rejections when you've only paid $375? Well, she didn't really know and wasn't too helpful, but ended up getting, you know, the full $500. You gotta, you know, follow up, keep on top of the things. I never figured out how to build Medicare. I worked for about 5 years without getting Medicare.
Is that right?
We now work with a large agency that does our Medicaid billing for us. Last year, I think. Of course, even this woman, this couple, where there was the drinking and the battering and whatnot, I had been putting my dates in faithfully. Last June. In December, I was told, oh, she's, her Medicaid's managed through an HMO. It won't pay. It was
no prior approval.
Oh, goodness.
You know, everybody just is running straight out. You feel so frustrated at something like this. And I'm going to go back to somebody and say, by the way, pay me.
Mm-hmm.
That's... if I had somebody who was willing to do, fine, you can do something.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But not people who don't have, you know, want money at their disposal.
Yeah.
Someone. I suppose. And then, you know, people switch from one to another,
mm-hmm.
change jobs,
mm-hmm.
and whatnot. And it's very difficult to know that you can stay with the same treaters.
Mm-hmm.
But all the boss, that was one thing you basically could do. Excuse me, in the old days, if you had Blue Cross, straight Blue Cross, there was a high probability that wherever you went to work, they would offer Blue Cross.
Mm-hmm.
And that you could keep seeing the same providers. It's harder and harder to these days. For some things, that's probably not that big a deal. For anything in the way of real therapeutic alliance that requires connection, certainly for counseling type of thing, and really for an awful lot of medical
stuff.
You need to stay with the same person. I would imagine at some point probably there will be something like a single payer system, or at least a lot more overlap.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long road. People don't recognize, people don't look that critically at their insurance policies and whatnot. And even if you look at them, there's stuff that isn't said. Mental health, addictions, up to $500 a calendar year. That's very common. What it doesn't say is, if you meet our criteria.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't meet that criteria, forget it.
And
you
speak not in 500.
That's right. And, you know, to get into an inpatient treatment, you have to meet the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And then you may get worked out every couple of days. And if you aren't deemed to meet criteria, insurance company says, oh, we're not telling you how to practice medicine. We're just saying we're not going to pay. There's a patient out the door.
Right.
So a lot of good things have happened. I think the emphasis on returning to family practice, working with patients is very important. I see that the new UMass curriculum is going to involve patient care for the first year,
mm-hmm.
and continuity, which is, there's so many different ways,
mm-hmm.
so many vastly different ways that is positive. Just from the human side of it, getting to know and follow somebody. From the intellectual side of it, from the opportunity to watch the regular physician, how they operate, and understand, to come to some understanding of the rules of the road where it comes to billing and management. That's all real important. And this is a very good way of doing it and weaving the
hold the science and what they are.
That's right.
And making it make sense.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was a second year, first year student, maybe, first or second year. I was still taking it out of my first year. One of my college classmates went into the physical therapy training program over in South of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we were visiting one day, and she was studying kinesiology, which is how the muscles work. And I'm listening to her talk about the muscles, and she's naming them off. Only to her, they're making sense.
Yeah.
You know, this biceps does this and that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought, wow, wouldn't it be nice to learn that way rather than just, you know, in a two-dimensional
right.
view. But
I just sort of as a wrap up, are there, can you think of, you know, maybe one really good thing and one really backtracking or a step in the wrong direction that you've seen since you first started medical school first?
I don't think I've spent probably too much time on what I see as the negative aspects of the payment system.
Mm-hmm.
I think as a positive thing, probably the growing sense of empowerment on the part of patients. I don't like using the term consumer. To me, consumer doesn't indicate the kind of connections the patient-doctor has.
Mm-hmm.
But the expectation that patients have that they will be informed to their degree of needs
mm-hmm.
of what options they have, the existence of options, the growing emphasis on health maintenance and not simply treatment of illness. I think this is in the family practice orientation certainly goes along with that.
Mm-hmm.
The increase in maternity and birth and so on. So return to home deliveries, workforce connection, hospitals, and problems. I think this is very, very important so that people can take. People can learn how to take a good deal of responsibility for their own lives
mm-hmm.
and utilize the medical system in appropriate ways to maximize that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You'll be seeing a lot of that.
Yeah. Right. Well, great. Listening to your story.
Okay, Laura.
I'm sure it would be a good addition to their library.
Thanks for coming.
Okay.